It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin prisons are going to start accepting new inmates starting next month. We'll check in with a WPR reporter who's been covering the impacts of coronavirus on the state's correctional facilities. First, tell me if this sounds familiar. You get together with your family, maybe for a holiday. After all the fun and good food, someone starts talking about, say, politics. Maybe a few people leave the table. For those that stay, the discussion gets tense, maybe even angry. Our next guest says that dynamic is in part because of a lot of us don't have the skills to make those conversations more compassionate and constructive. Diane Musho-Hamilton is an author, award-winning mediator, and a teacher of Zen. She's the co-author of the new book, Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, how common is this problem, Diane? We have this big issue in our lives, maybe personal, maybe political. We recognize the value in talking about it, but we just don't really have the skills to do it in a productive way.
Well, we all have good conversations every day where we get along and we agree and we present some level of difference. But when the differences are more threatening, it's harder to have a conversation. And in politics, our most deeply held values are at stake, so it often just feels a little more threatening.
When it comes to these tough issues, like, say, race or religious differences, things like that, there's one really easy approach and that's that a lot of us, I think, take, and that's to avoid the topic, not talk about it all. What do we lose if we just don't take these things head on?
Well, it's as I said before, to really acknowledge how much we have in common, how much we actually do get along, and the fact that humans are one of the most cooperative species on the planet. But when our differences arise, they capture our attention because they affect our nervous system differently. So in the same way that, you know, when the nervous system is relaxed and we're listening and we feel the same as people, it feels one way. And then as soon as there are differences, the nervous system gets excited. There's adrenaline, there's cortisol. And as soon as that difference starts to become threatening, it's very different, difficult to remain in the conversation. But we lose our ability to actually hold multiple perspectives, to hear one another. And sometimes, as you know, it stresses our relationships. So a lot is lost when we're not willing to talk to each other.
I want to amplify that one point you made because I pulled a quote from your book. Surprising as it may be, just discussing differences often feels threatening. Conversations about differences can easily provoke a fight or flight response. So in a way, our biology is actually making it harder for us to have these conversations?
Absolutely. That's what happens, is that the nervous system at rest feels one way. And when there's commonality, it's the, they call it the feed and breed nervous system. And as soon as we start to express differences, then all of a sudden our defense system starts to excite a little bit and we will feel that dripping of cortisol and adrenaline. And it's very, lots of times when we even are trying to have a good conversation, we're doing a lot of coping. So it's important that we understand that about our nervous system and we use listening to soothe ourselves. And then when we start to bring up differences, notice the excitement. And any time that we're overexcited or it starts to be threatening, just add more listening, more reflection, more joining. And when you do that, it'll calm everything down and then you can bring up the differences again.
And you, in the book, you and your co-authors say, we can learn from your mediation skills by practicing a bit of meditation, by focusing on our breathing and things like that to keep ourselves in the moment and to not let ourselves get distracted by that fight or flight response. Can you give us a concrete tip of how we can do that?
Yeah, so meditation and listening both have a lot in common. So I'm both a meditator and a mediator. So I would say that two things that can really be helpful is one is when people start to feel their nervous system get excited in that way, to notice it, to just pay attention to it. And you can use the breath by simply noticing the inhale, lengthening the exhale. Even if you do it three times, four times, it will help to recalibrate your nervous system. And then just, if you can, just tune into the truth, whatever tiny relative truth that the other person is saying, and just reflect that back. So it may be, for instance, here's an example from this morning. My sister and brother live in different parts of the country. They're having different experiences around the virus. My sister lives in an urban center. It's much more threatening. My brother lives in Alaska, so his emphasis is on the economy. My sister told me she did a really good job of reflecting that, yeah, it's really, really important that we get the economy started. And it may be different, you know, in places where there's more population. So it's great that things are a little more gentle in Alaska, and here where I'm living, things are a little bit more stressed. So there's a way to kind of listen, join, create relaxation, and then just present some differences in a way that are respectful, but you don't have to just move away. So that's an example.
We're talking to Diane Musho Hamilton, co-author of the new book, Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. I want to key in on another quote that I definitely have witnessed a lot in my life. Here it is. Typically, most of us engage in conversations about race, gender, politics, or religion, not to grow our heart, but to confirm our own personal beliefs and perceptions, including proving others wrong. How can we find a better starting point for a conversation than showing that I'm right and you're wrong?
Well, the thing about conversation is that it's an art form. So if you get just the right amount of commonality, it's like good music. There's a really consistent rhythm section that creates a kind of an undertone that carries the melody. And then the differences are like the melody. And so it makes it exciting and interesting. And we learn a lot. And we actually grow through the encounter with difference. So unless we're willing to encounter difference and talk about it, our perspectives don't change. Our world doesn't get bigger. We don't have new insights. So growth is really related to the encounter with difference. Even evolution works that way. It moves from sameness to difference, and then it becomes more complex and more complex. And that's how we grow and change as well. When we need to be right, when everything becomes kind of a win-lose proposition, we usually end up feeling separate, alienated, and the fulfillment and the gratification of a good conversation is lost because it's simply a win-lose, zero-sum situation.
Can we train ourselves, or I guess get trained, to become better at having these kind of conversations?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's good for us to start. If you pick up the book, the things that I emphasize are, first of all, really get to know your nervous system and pay attention to when it's relaxed and when it becomes elevated or threatened. The second thing is really develop your listening skills so that any time you want, when something is too stressful, you can simply learn how to reflect and join with and lower the stress levels, and then present your differences in a way that are exciting and not threatening. And then finally, always finish conversations by reiterating the area of commonality. What is it that we actually agree about? We agree that we all want everyone to feel safe. We want people to be healthy, and we want people to have jobs and be able to pay their mortgages. Those are all things that we agree about. We should be able to have that conversation.
You've mentioned those listening skills a few times, and you use the phrase a reflective listening in the book. Can you spell out what that means?
Yeah, sometimes it's referred to as active listening. So basically, it's the skill of simply repeating and really finding a way to see the truth in what you hear someone say. Listening doesn't mean agreement. That's important. It doesn't mean agreement, but it means that you give them the experience that you've heard what they've said, you repeat some of the language, and you basically give them the experience that they've been heard. Listening is not about what you heard. It's about the experience that you give the speaker. Does the speaker feel heard? Because when people feel heard, they relax.
A lot of the examples in your book focus on issues related to race here in the United States. Can you offer some tips for conversations, especially when you have people from maybe different racial backgrounds, white and black, different experiences, mm-hmm. different levels of privilege in their lives, whether or not they think mm-hmm. of it consciously as privilege? How can we get started mm-hmm. on what's that very sensitive topic?
Well, I think that, again, what is it we all have in common, and that we all have life experience in which we've suffered, and we all have life experience in which things have been challenging or we've experienced loss. If you're in a position of more privilege or more power, in this case, if you're a person who's white, your obligation at this point right now in history is to listen, because we've had really different experiences and we need to be educated about what people of color experience on a daily basis that we don't. And when you become a good listener and you actually join with and reflect the truths and the differences, and that you demonstrate an interest in really caring about what other people's experience is, it's amazing how much can be accomplished in conversation. A lot of energy gets wasted when people feel that they're being accused or being told they've done something wrong. It's really not about that. It's really about being willing just to hear an experience that's vastly different from your own. And then once people establish rapport, then it's really nice for regardless of what your race or your identity is, to be able to exchange truths. But in certain situations, like sometimes I would say for males, it's nice to listen for a little while before you assert your truth, just because maybe for a lot of women, they haven't been listened to quite as easily or well. So in this case, it's just a little bit of courtesy, of giving people the experience who haven't had their voice be heard as readily, to actually give them the experience that they're being seen and heard. It's important.
We're talking to author and mediator Diane Musho Hamilton. Her latest book, she's the co-author of Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you deal with uncomfortable conversations about things like politics or race? Do you find these conversations typically turning into arguments for you? Have you found maybe a better way to talk about topics between you and your family or someone else you disagree with? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about how to have more compassionate and constructive conversations, even with people we disagree with, especially with people that we have disagreements with. Diane Musho Hamilton is with us, author of the new book, Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a story of a tough conversation you had recently and how it went for you with a friend or loved one, or maybe a stranger, classmate, coworker? Are you someone who avoids people who think differently than you do, or do you have people in your life from different backgrounds and you value communicating and sharing the things that are the same about you and the things that are different about your experiences? Do you have questions for our guest about how to have better, more productive conversations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Diane, you and your co-authors in the book talk about some of us might lean more toward rationality and pride ourselves on being very reasonable and logical in our conversations. Other people might lead more with their emotions. You say we need some of both. Can you tell us how to set that balance?
Yes, well, there is a difference lots of times when people engage, in that some people really have a very logical, linear, and rational way of expressing themselves, and some people are, and they're much more considered maybe before they speak, and other people speak from the heart or from the gut, and there's more emotion and energy. And what we know is that we love both, you know, because when we have conversations that have emotion, they're usually energized, and when we have conversations with rationality, they can be quite calming and help us understand what a strategy to move forward might be. So I think it's really important that we engage kind of our gut, our heart, and our rationality in our conversations, because that's where the most life force is when we have all three of our centers, keeping in mind that rationality does help us to calm down and also, but you have to, what helps us calm down more than anything is to be heard. So I'm going back to listening skills and back to giving people the experience they've been heard and valued.
Let's talk about when things go wrong. We're not perfect. We might have had that conversation where we weren't at our best. Mm-hmm. How do we come back to, say, that friend or coworker or whatever and reopen the door that may have felt like it slammed shut?
Okay, it's just kind of a simple regrouping. You know, you might say something like, oh, that conversation got away from me the other day. I really care about what it is you have to say, and I don't feel like I listen very well. Would you mind reopening it? And then if you do a good job of listening, you could say, that sounds really reasonable. Are you interested in hearing my perspective on that? Because I still do have a difference with you. So it's just a matter of regrouping. I always tell my students, it's not what you do, it's what you do next. And usually people will want to reengage. So I think, and the only way for us to learn, of course, is to practice over and over and over and over, and then we get better at it. So coming back to someone is a good idea.
Now, you and your colleagues have worked with people in workplace settings, academic settings, and even looked at, I think, places after major, conflicts within nations, civil wars, things like that. I imagine at some of those points, things looked hopeless to some of the participants. There's no hope of building a bridge. Is there always some kind of hope?
You know, I think that, the willingness of human beings to engage and get along is really, really high. And there are often structural problems. There are often inequities that are difficult to surmount. So there are genuine obstacles that have to be overcome sometimes for people to be brought together. But, you know, sometimes when that happens in groups that I work with, I will just allow groups to split up, kind of go to their own sides, take a while to just talk among themselves and say, you know, is there anything that you can do differently that would actually help us to succeed? And I ask each small group to do that, and almost inevitably they find things they can do differently. You know, it's difficult. It's difficult when you work with really, really multi-generational conflicts, or conflicts in which real, genuine resources are at stake, or conflicts in which they're just structural problems. Around, you know, I worked in a mediation where a fraternity house was located in a really quiet neighborhood, and that was just a structural problem. There's almost no solution to that except to move the fraternity house out of the neighborhood. So sometimes you just have to make changes so that you can get to a result. And these things often take time. You know, I always tell people, keep in mind that when we learn about having conversation, every important social movement is based on years and years and years of people talking to each other. And sometimes it takes a really long time to get to where we want to be, but it's always worth it, and there's always hope.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ruth is with us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how one begins to open something up, because when somebody believes that having a visceral response means that they're right, that it's how they gauge whether or not they're mm-hmm. right, because they mm-hmm. have a visceral response. You know, your comment about fight and flight is really mm-hmm. a good one, and I appreciated that. But how mm-hmm. might you, as a mediator, touch mm-hmm. on that or begin to open the door a little bit where, you know, there are people who hold that belief?
Yeah, well, and also I would just mention that different families, different cultures, different groups have different tolerances for emotional expression. And sometimes when I'm working with a group, I'll say, hey, we're going to talk about this hot topic. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much emotion can this group tolerate? So certain groups, you'll find that they 2 or 3 is all they can really take, and other groups, it's like 8 or 9. So my suggestion would be if you're in a conversation with someone who kind of, there's a lot of emotional intensity and that equates to their being right, you could say something like, I really want to have this conversation, and what I notice is when the emotional intensity gets so high, I lose my ability to listen, and I really want to be able to hear what you have to say. Could we kind of try to keep it at like a 3 or 4 just so I can stay present? Something like that.
Ruth, thanks a lot for that call. I hope that helps. We are talking about having good, productive conversations about difficult issues. We have Diane Musho Hamilton with us. She's co-author of the book, Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. Diane, a lot of what you're saying makes me think, you know, a big part of this is listening to other people, but a lot of it seems like it's listening to clues and cues coming from within ourselves, too.
Absolutely. What an absolutely great insight. We have to become equally as good at listening to ourselves, what's happening in our body, what kind of emotions that we happen to be feeling, what are the most important thoughts that we're having. So listening to ourselves so that we can express ourselves is every bit as important as listening to others. But listening to others will always calm the situation, will always calm it. And then you can kind of prepare the ground to bring up your difference. So it takes some generosity to be the person to do the listening first, but the better that we get at it, the more we create kind of an open field in which our differences can excite and stimulate us without coming between us.
Now, we live in a country where we hear talk about political polarization a lot. Mm-hmm. It seems like we're not real good at listening to each other sometimes. From your vantage point, though, working with actual, you know, individuals, not just sort of these big picture groups, do you feel optimistic that we can do this?
Oh, yeah, I think so for sure. I think we're getting better and better and better at it. I believe that one of the first chapter in the book is really about, I really like people to think about conversation as a skill that we're acquiring, that literally is part of our development and our evolution, that we're getting better and better at it. And that, you know, for some people, even the idea that there could be two perspectives that are equally valid, that will create anxiety. And so they'll drop back and just cling to one truth. But over time, people get better and better and better at seeing how multiple perspectives can have truths. And then they get better at being able to hold that complexity. So that's an acquired skill. And after 40 years of practicing, I still notice times when I'm good at it and times when I'm not very good at it. So I tell people, just keep in mind, we're building the pyramids here. This is going to take time, but look how far we've come.
You can see where this would have a social benefit. Is there a case to be made that if we open ourselves up to other people's experiences, even if we don't, you know, change our minds as a result, that we're living a richer life ourselves?
I think so. Absolutely. I mean, if you think about any time we've ever learned anything, it's from somebody who knows something we don't, who is better at something than we are, who's had more of a particular kind of experience. And so we don't grow unless we open up to these differences. Now, again, you know, it's one thing to open up to someone who's interested in exchanging with you, who has a different experience, than somebody who attacks you. It's much harder when someone's attacking you. But even over time, you can start to learn how to, you know, sort of let that drift, if you will, and just go for what is it they're saying that's important to them.
Briefly, do you have thoughts? A lot of our interactions with acquaintances and strangers, especially these days, are online. Do you have a quick thought on how to listen, even though it's just, you know, text from somebody in another house somewhere?
Well, again, you know, I guess I'm kind of, you know, harping on this a little bit, but I think one of the challenges of online, whether it's email or text or whatever, is we never reflect. We never say, so is what you're saying dot, 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 or do I understand that dot, dot, dot? We just simply respond. And lots of times we haven't actually heard the message clearly. And that's why the reflection can be so helpful, is just to say, here's what I think I hear you saying. Is that right? Just take a minute to do that. It can make a huge difference.
Diane, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Really appreciate it.
That's Diane Musho-Hamilton, mediator and co-author of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Compassionate Conversations, How to Speak and Listen from the Heart. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin's Department of Corrections stopped admitting offenders back when the state's Safer at Home order went into effect. We'll learn about the effect that had on the system and how facilities plan to take in prisoners again. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been nearly 2 weeks since the Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's stay-at-home order. After a busy Memorial Day weekend, we look at how the state is doing in its battle against COVID-19. First, while much of the state was in a sense locked down during the safer-at-home order, a whole other population of people in Wisconsin has had to deal with the coronavirus while actually being locked down, the incarcerated and the staff in correctional facilities. The Department of Corrections put a hold on prisoner admissions back in March, but it's planning to allow them to resume gradually starting June 1st. That's amid concerns over the health and safety of both prisoners and facility staff. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She's been covering the impact of the coronavirus on Wisconsin's prison system. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks, Rob.
Let's start by talking about the kinds of closing up that the state's correctional facilities had way back in March after the first Safer at Home order. What did we see then?
Yeah, so back in March, you know, they had, there was an executive order that Governor Tony Evers issued asking the Department of Corrections to halt all admissions to state prisons. And they took a number of steps, too, to prevent the spread of COVID-19 among institutions, things like, you know, limiting to facilities, preventing people from coming to see inmates, also preventing transfers between facilities. So those were some of the things that happened early on. But as you know, testing and personal protective equipment were something that were in short supply in the beginning of this.
How much has the coronavirus hit the correctional system in Wisconsin, as far as we know, given the kind of testing we've had?
Yeah, so right now, as of today, Tuesday the 26th, we've had just about under 1,300 tests that have been done of prisoners or people being held at correctional facilities across the state, the majority of those tests are still pending. You know, we've got 54 tests for coronavirus within institutions statewide. And so as we've seen more testing, then we've seen more cases of COVID-19. Right now, it looks like there's about 12% of those that have been tested have COVID-19.
And what do prisons in the state do when they have a positive test for an inmate?
That's a good question, Rob. You know, when they find a confirmed case of COVID-19, they, well, first off, in right away, their movement is limited in the institutions to prevent any spread between inmates. And then when they find a positive case, their movement is limited even further, and inmates are more confined to their cells. And that can look like either isolation or quarantine. And both, I think, recommendations by the Centers for Disease Control would say that you would have those prisoners housed within a single cell by themselves. Basically, for the DOC, the state DOC, when you have a quarantine, it means you're separating and restricting inmates' movements. But isolation means that you're separating sick people experiencing symptoms from those who are well.
You reported that the Department of Corrections is planning to resume admitting prisoners to correctional facilities starting at the beginning of next month. Now, what's that going to look like?
Well, it's going to be limited. Right now, the Corrections Secretary, Kevin Carr, has said that they're working with county sheriffs one-on-one to determine, you know, just how many new admissions they can accept from county jails. And they're doing this in part because county sheriffs have expressed a desire to start transferring individuals to state prisons because they're seeing increasing populations of their own since they haven't been able to transfer individuals to those correctional facilities.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, talking about how the state's prison system is handling the coronavirus and COVID-19 testing, quarantines, and more. Danny, you talked to a woman named Letitia Dennis who had written to WPR's Wisconsin Project. Her fiance is being held at Dodge Correctional Institution. What are her concerns?
Well, she's worried about her fiance because he has COPD, which is a chronic lung disease. And so that makes him more susceptible to contracting COVID-19. And she really wants to see her fiance released from prison because he's a nonviolent offender who's eligible for release within the next year. And she's had concerns about how things are being handled within the correctional system.
They are cleaning everything in the prison, swabbing, you know, everything now. But they weren't doing that before, you know, when they first knew about the COVID-19. It just took them until recently. So they don't know if it's there or not.
And so what has Letitia heard anything from the correctional institutions? Is there a way to petition for a release related to COVID-19? Is there any kind of process that we know about?
Yes, you can petition for release, but so far we've seen about 1,500 or so people that have either been released from a hold in county jails or have been released from the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility or from prison altogether on things like certain earned release. You know, basically, Secretary Kevin Carr is saying that his authority is limited to release individuals from prison. But groups like Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, or EXPO, and the ACLU of Wisconsin have said that they could use their authority under state law to release individuals from prison due to this health crisis.
And Danny, something that came out of your reporting here, we might think of somebody going into prison as likely to be a younger person, but as you report, there are a fair number of people in the correctional system who are older or maybe have health conditions. There are significant numbers of people who might be considered at risk to COVID-19 currently in prison.
Yeah, I'm looking at a Legislative Reference Bureau report that was put together this spring, and they're showing, you know, around 12% or so of Wisconsin's prison inmates are over the age of 54, and that's from 2018. So there are quite a few people who are in that higher risk category being held right now in the state's prison. And it's just a difficult situation in general, too, because social distancing in the state's correctional facilities is difficult at best or impossible at worst, to quote from this report, because it is such a confined setting. And we have seen our state facilities maxed out beyond capacity.
And as we wrap up, Danny, we've been focusing on the inmates for the most part. You also heard from unions that represent some of the staff at prisons. What are we hearing from them?
Yeah, union workers or union representatives are saying that the rights of correctional staff are, or the voices of correctional staff are limited because they don't have the rights to bargain they did prior to Act 10. And they're saying that basically correctional workers should have more of a voice in the testing and the personal protective equipment and all these decisions that are being made that affect them and their health within the state prison system.
We'll leave it there. Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. We talked to her today about how Wisconsin's prisons are managing the coronavirus within their walls. Coming up, we'll check in with a doctor about how the state is doing against the coronavirus. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while we're not exactly living in happy times, there are ways to find a little joy in every day. We'll ask you to share how you are feeling joy these days, and we'll hear some inspiring stories along the way. First, it was 2 weeks ago tomorrow that the Wisconsin State Supreme Court struck down Governor Evers' stay-at-home order. It was scheduled to expire originally today. Since then, a lot of people have headed to taverns, barbershops, and other destinations that were deemed non-essential during the shutdown. While there's now no statewide order in effect, there are still a handful of local stay-at-home policies. For example, Dane County allowed all businesses to open at 25% capacity this morning. According to the State Department of Health Services, nearly 7,800 COVID-19 tests were processed yesterday. About 280 came back positive. That's 3.6%, the lowest percentage in 8 days. A little fewer than 400 people are hospitalized. With a Memorial weekend in the books and summer-like weather settling in, how is Wisconsin doing in its fight against the coronavirus? Dr. Jeffrey Potthoff is the Chief Quality and Safety Officer at UW Health and an emergency medical physician. Dr. Potthoff, nice to have you back on Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me on your show today.
Well, from your medical standpoint, what are your general thoughts about where we are in Wisconsin right now when it comes to COVID-19?
Yeah, I think for the most part, we're in a transition point. So Wisconsin, I think, was pretty successful early on implementing some mitigation strategies that helped us flatten the curve. Early on, when we were planning as a health system, we expected a full-on surge of patients, much like we had seen early on kind of in Washington and then New York. And through the efforts of really the community, we didn't have that kind of surge where we were overrun with patients. And now, you know, as time has gone on, we are trying to figure out how do we balance COVID-19 with the idea that we also need to figure out how to get our economy going. And that's where we are taking these efforts to hopefully safely do some things. And we know that anytime we mingle more, we'll see more cases. I think the jury is still out on, as we go about this, will we see, you know, small rises in cases or undetectable? Or will we not be able to do this in a safe manner and we'll start to see a more rapid rise in cases? In the next few weeks will help us see what happens.
Staying in the past for a bit, some people might read our numbers. You know, we didn't have that surge you mentioned. We didn't have that out-of-control spiral at some other places. I think some people are looking at that and saying, oh, the problem was overblown in the first place. We didn't need the safer-at-home stuff. It wasn't that big a deal. What would you say to that reaction?
Yeah, I think that's funny because early on, before we knew that flattening the curve was going to work, I had said that, you know, the best way to know that our mitigation efforts worked was people would say that we overreacted and this was overblown because the proof in the pudding is that you don't get a surge, you don't get a lot of patients. You know, in a way, I think it's good. It's kind of the evidence that we're looking for that says those efforts that people took were actually effective because naysayers may say, you know, we didn't have all these deaths. We didn't have, you know, all this disease. And that was the point exactly, to prevent that.
Looking at the numbers again here in the state, have we seen changes since the Safer at Home order was struck down, at least so far?
Probably regional. I know here at UW Health, our inpatient volume of COVID patients is increased, and it's about 2 weeks since that Supreme Court decision. It's hard to know if that's directly related or if there's other factors. But the story of Wisconsin, there's been some regional variation in cases. Dane County has done a really nice job with flattening the curve. And then, as you know, there's other counties that struggled a little bit more. Brown County had some hot spots. Rock County had some hot spots. And I think that might be kind of what we see going forward, is different areas popping up based on different circumstances.
We could have, you know, extremes on either point, you know, full on safer at home, back to normal like it never happened, or we act like it never happened. What kind of precautions are you hoping that people take as they go back out to shop or work or recreate or whatever?
Yeah, as a healthcare provider, I like these phased approaches. So I think all of us realize that, you know, a hard lockdown, stay at home, going on for forever is just not doable. But I also think that some people think that because, you know, the lockdown is over, it's just back to how it was in May of 2019. And that's just not the case. That's an equally dangerous position to be in. So the idea that, you know, we get back into this, but we still preserve some of these mitigation strategies, most importantly, physical distancing. Secondarily, keeping masked in these public places. I think those are the strategies that allow us to successfully determine if we can kind of roll back into this, keep ourselves safe, but at the same time, keep the economy going. So I think these are smart ways to do it. I think we should react to the data that comes back from that, and that'll be the way that we can actually move forward. What I'd hate to see is everyone kind of going forward like everything is back to normal and then find out that the disease is spiking and we have to be more restrictive again. I think that's the last thing anyone wants to see as we turn the corner into summer.
I want to get your thoughts on the wearing of masks. We see, you know, in the news, in places that have been hit hard by COVID-19, a lot of peer pressure to get people to wear masks. In places where it hasn't hit, we see stories of people being made fun of for wearing masks. Where should we be with the masks right now?
Yeah, I mean, really, from the health and safety perspective, the mask is for the person who is asymptomatic, i.e. has no symptoms, but actually does have the disease. We know that those people can spread the disease fairly easily and infect other people. So if you're in a situation where you're in public and you're going to be closer than 6 feet to other individuals, all of us, even if we feel well, should probably have that facial covering on. And I know, you know, early on when we tried to get people to wear seatbelts, we got made fun of for wearing seatbelts too. I think this just needs to be the new normal as we deal with COVID, that it is okay to wear a mask when you're in public because it keeps us safe. It keeps me safe. It keeps you safe. And it just needs to be something that we have better acceptance of in kind of our new normal of living with COVID.
And I want to key in on one of the points there. If I am that asymptomatic carrier, I have the virus, I don't have symptoms, odds are I don't know that I have the virus, right? Unless I happen to get a test for some reason.
Right, that's exactly it. It's not really the healthy people that we're worried about, and that's why the guidance on masks changed, you know, back in March. It really is people who will feel 100% fine but are spreading virus. And if they give it to someone who's going to have a bad outcome, I don't think that's something that any of us wants to do. None of us wants to make someone else sick.
We're talking to Dr. Jeff Potthoff. He's the Chief Quality and Safety Officer at UW Health and an emergency medical physician. Dr. Potthoff, I want you to take us into the hospital now. What have we learned over the last 2 months about keeping the patients safe and keeping the staff safe as well?
Yeah, we've learned a lot, Rob. So, you know, early on in the days of COVID-19, a lot of the things that we kind of accept as common practice right now, whether it be social distancing, masking, was pretty foreign. We struggled with testing ability. We couldn't test all the people we wanted to test. We were worried that we were going to run out of personal protective equipment. And those things aren't all, you know, 100% perfect. But for the most part, with time now, our PPE supplies are much better. Our ability to test is much better. We know that the PPE that our staff is using is keeping them safe. We know that it keeps our patients safe. And for those reasons, we've been able to turn back on some of those essential services that we needed to turn off while we got this all figured out. So, the hospital today is different than the hospital that you might have been in January. We physically distance. We screen people when they come in. We check temperatures. Everyone is wearing a mask and a face shield. If patients don't have a mask, we provide them with one. And we're now able to effectively carry out normal healthcare services that people really need without exposing them to risks of COVID-19. And we think that's really important. We know some people were scared to come to the hospital because they thought they could get sick from COVID. We have pretty good data that says that's not the case. And if you need to come to the hospital for your healthcare needs, that's a safe place to do it. We've got processes in place that do allow us to do all these mitigation strategies while still provide really great healthcare to you.
And I've heard from a couple of other emergency healthcare workers who really wanted to hammer that point home. If you're having an emergency, the symptoms of a heart attack or stroke in particular, but others as well, still come to the emergency room. Like, that's not the kind of thing you put off because you're worried about the virus. I assume you agree with them too?
Absolutely. I mean, I've heard some stories from a few of our docs of, patients who did put off those symptoms of a heart attack, did put off those symptoms of stroke, and now they're in a much worse position. And it breaks our heart because we knew that if had they come in earlier, we'd have been able to take care of that condition. They would have had a better chance. So we definitely want the message to be out there that if you need to access healthcare, if you need to come to the emergency department for chest pain or for weakness on one side of your body, absolutely do that. We don't want you putting that off right now.
How about those non-emergency procedures that were being put off? Are we getting somewhere close to normal scheduling for those?
We're doing better with it, and we really, call it kind of essential services, and a good example might be a hip replacement. We had some patients who their hip pain was so bad that they were basically immobile. They couldn't get around, and their quality of life was just horrendous. And early on in COVID, those weren't, life-threatening procedures or things that, would save your life, and we would have postponed them. But we started hearing from providers that, a procedure that they postponed for 1 month, 2 months, this wasn't something that we could expect to postpone for forever, that this was really impacting people's lives. So we're able to do more of those things. And we have our doctors prioritizing, kind of the importance, not just from, life and limb threatening, but also from a quality life standpoint. And we're able to get a lot more of those people in. We're still not back to normal. We're still not doing things that I would say are, completely elective. But we are getting a lot of those things done that really make a difference in people's lives.
As you mentioned, we've learned a lot about COVID-19, and you're talking about in a hospital setting how to deal with it. What are some of the open questions that you want to see answers for, hopefully sooner than later?
Yeah, the thing that's on my mind the most right now is I think it's important that we're trying to reopen some of these things, and I see a lot of efforts by business owners to do the right thing, providing masks for staff, marking off their floors with, 6 feet of distance, asking that patrons and customers wear masks and practice social distancing. What will be interesting to see is, as we do this, will we all stick together and do these things, which aren't always fun, i.e., queue in a line that's 6 foot apart or wear a mask into a store. But a lot of us realize that, this is really the key to getting us back more normal. So over the next week or two, it'll be interesting to see when we get feedback from these businesses or we see the video on TV, are people doing these things so that we can be on a good trajectory of getting things going sooner? Or will they disregard some of these measures? And will we see lots of people congregating close together, no masks, and potentially see more cases, which could actually set us apart from our shared goal, which is, staying safe, but getting the economy going. So I look forward to seeing how we can band together and make sure that we're doing what we need to do as a community to get through this.
In our last minute, can you leave us with just your couple key pieces of advice for us as we go about our business, even if you're repeating yourself a bit?
Yeah, I think, one, assess your personal risk. So if you're older and you have comorbidities, you should think a little bit more carefully about doing something in public than someone who has no risk factors. I think a big thing is to then think about the risk that you're taking on versus the benefit that you would get by doing some of these things. And something where you're masked and you're passing by someone very briefly in a grocery store is relatively low risk. If you're in a bar and you're not masked and you're close and you're speaking or yelling loudly, that's a much higher risk activity. And I think, it'd be nice if people would maybe avoid those situations just really kind of assess, you know, what is my risk versus my benefit when I do these things, and just encourage people to avoid these risky behaviors. COVID-19 isn't gone yet. It's still here. It's still making people sick, and it's still killing people, but we need to try to do these things safely, and I think if we follow the guidance closely, we've got a good chance of doing okay with this right now.
Dr. Potthoff, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me on the show, Rob.
That's Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality and Safety Officer at UW Health. He's an emergency medical physician. We talked to him about how Wisconsin is doing right now in the ongoing effort to contain COVID-19.
You are too late. My blood now flows through her veins. She will live through the centuries to come, as I have lived.
Fighting words there from Count Dracula, as played by Bela Lugosi. Van Helsing may have spoiled his evil scheme, but Dracula has enjoyed a long lifespan, and today is his birthday, his literary birthday anyway. On this day in 1897, Bram Stoker's novel Dracula hit bookstores for the first time in London. The Irish author wrote 17 novels in all, plus short stories, but Dracula was the big one. As reported on the History Channel website, Dracula actually wasn't a huge success in Stoker's own lifetime. It did okay, and it wasn't even mentioned in his obituary when he died in 1912. But a Broadway adaptation in the 1920s and then the movie version with Bela Lugosi turned the book into a huge success. Here's a fun fact I just learned today. In earlier drafts of the novel, Count Dracula was known as Count Vampire, which I feel like might have been a bit of a spoiler for the readers. It takes a lot of the mystery out of where this whole thing could be going. So tonight, raise a glass in honor of Dracula's birthday. A glass of, you know, water or milk or wine or anything, but you know. Undead news you can use. This is Central Time.